Hello all, and welcome to the Book Spider Podcast, a podcast for people who love books but hate entertainment. My name is Chris Malmberg, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Patrick Barney and Hans Berger. Today we're talking about Douglas Adams' novel, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Since it first appeared as a radio play in 1978, the book has been adapted and readapted into the novel we read for this episode, into other radio plays, into television miniseries, movies, video games, comic books, and plays, many times over for decades. The image of whales and petunias falling from the sky are popular tattoos. Even I have such a tattoo. The phrase "don't panic" and the number 42 appear just about everywhere you can imagine, from the music of Coldplay to the X-Files to the number of satellite dishes deployed by the Allen Telescope Array, which is part of SETI, the search for extraterrestrial life. There's even a book of philosophy with essays organized entirely around the philosophical ideas from the Hitchhiker's Guide series. So that's all kind of interesting because this book is super silly. And considering how silly it is, its staying power is kind of confounding. And that's actually a little bit of what I'd like to dig into with my questions. I certainly will be talking about the book itself, but in reading it for what is probably the fourth time in my case, and I did have a great time reading it again, I was struck by an inability to pin down exactly why this book is so special, even though I do think it is special. It seems to hover in this Lagrange point between absurd farce, incisive social satire, and existential ennui in a way that makes it difficult to really kind of circumscribe when Adams is being serious or when he's being playful. Maybe because he's being both all the time. Anyway, the plot goes like this. The Earth is demolished to make way for a hyperspace bypass. Arthur Dent, a human, is saved from its destruction by an alien calling himself Ford Prefect, a writer for The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. They're discovered hiding aboard one of the Vogon ships that destroyed the Earth and are thrown off into space. They're then rescued from suffocation by the improbable appearance of the Heart of Gold, a ship that moves by manipulating probability, flown by Ford's old friend Zaphod Beeblebrox, the depressed robot Marvin, and a girl that Arthur spends way too much time still thinking about 6 months after meeting her for a short time at a party, Trillian. The five of them traveled to Magrathea, an ancient factory for bespoke planets, where they learn that the Earth was manufactured 5 or so million years back as part of a massive research moonshot funded by mice, who happen to be the most intelligent species on Earth, unlike how we tend to think of things. And they created the Earth to calculate the ultimate question for the ultimate answer to life, the universe, and everything. And the Earth, which is actually just a giant computer, was just a few minutes from spitting out the answer to the life, the universe, and everything, or rather the question to the answer of the life, the universe, and everything, when the Vogons demolish it. Magrathea is building a new Earth for its clients, the mice, when Arthur, Trillian, Zaphod, and Ford arrive. Learning that Arthur is human, the mice decide to look for the ultimate question in his brain, but he and his friends escape. And it occurred to me kind of writing this that I probably should have had us read both this and The Restaurant at the End of the Universe because they actually kind of describe a little bit more of a chewy arc. Some things are sort of dropped in this first book of the series that only come to fruition in the second. But it's fine. I think The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is enough, especially to kind of get at the themes and some of the things that Douglas Adams is doing in this series. And with that, I'm also sort of conscious of the fact that this book is pretty slight, and I couldn't really come up with too many questions about the content in particular. Maybe in sort of discussing it, we'll see where the conversation goes. But my first question is, I'm kind of curious about what still resonates from this novel going on 50 years since it was written. Why do people still love it? Why, it seems to me, is it going to continue to be popular for some time? Do you share in some or all of that appreciation why or why not?
I don't. First, I object to the question. 50 years. It was written. I mean, it was made into a play in 1978, but it was made into a novel in 1980. I was born in 1982. I'm 41. Fucker. I'm not 50.
I think Jesus. Like in a few years you will be 50. Like in 1978. In
9 years.
1978. I know that the novel was written in 1981, but the story, the conception of it, like basically, like that's the thing. I'm glad you pointed this out, Patrick.
45
because,
years.
Because you were not like an idea before you were born. Like there wasn't like a conception of Patrick Barney that was more or less a complete draft several years before Patrick Barney materialized
about?
As a zygote.
God has a conception.
This
of
is such a bad beginning to the podcast, guys. Like all the Hitchhiker's Guide fans who just sat through the giant fucking synopsis of a novel that we've all read more times than we can handle. They were all waiting for us to actually start talking about the book, and instead we're having some inane argument about whether or not it is in fact almost 50 years old.
In 5 years, the story will be. In 5 years, the story will be 50 years old. In
you're not the one with
the
inane
so
position,
years.
Patrick.
Yeah. So anyway, but go ahead, Patrick. You put yourself out there. What? Why does this book resonate with the like a really kind of broad subset of scientists, pop culture? It's broadly like found throughout like. A kind of like an intersection of science and pop culture still. And I think that it's going to stick around for a while.
Maybe for like the part. So the science fiction the hard science fiction enthusiast as inside in me, and as opposed to the soft science fiction enthusiast who is much smaller and not as much of a motivator for me personally. The hard science fiction enthusiast definitely thinks that the improbability drive is pretty interesting, like as a concept. So I could see like scientists being very interested in that. You know, this idea of an improbability drive that generates improbabilities as a way of traveling through space. Which causes like cool, strange things to happen, like petunia and a whale emerging from nowhere, and you know the whale falls to its brutal death. that's certainly an interesting scientific idea. So I could see you know being interested in that, and just. And maybe philosophers too, since the whole most of the humor of the novel seems to be grounded in like logical contradiction, if that makes sense. You know, so the existence, for example, the existence of the translator worm or the translator fish. What's the name of that thing?
The babblefish.
The babblefish. So the existence of the babblefish is so highly improbable that it is taken to be a sign that God does not exist somehow. Because, you know, it's so improbable that God would have thought about it and, you know, not
made
it.
God would have had to have designed it. Yeah.
So that's like an example of like I would say the humor based in logical impossibilities that
no we should play that out because it's like a contradiction of a contradiction of a contradiction
right.
The babblefish is such a clear sign that God exists that it's actually a sign that God doesn't exist because God demands faith and faith demands that God doesn't prove he exists and so the babblefish being proof that God exists actually disproves God
right yeah. So, yeah, like that's a super interesting philosophical idea. It's akin to other philosophical paradoxes, you know, like Achilles and the tortoise or whatever. So that's pretty interesting. And, you know, it's that I mean, I can definitely see staying power in those ideas from the science / philosophical community. Go on.
I have two thoughts about why it might endure. I'm going to say, first of all, I'm going to have to do a little bit of a heel turn, because a heel turn in the wrestling sense, right? Because, like, I have to admit that I did not find it to be an encompassing pleasure to revisit this novel.
It's totally fine. No, it's no, it's good radio. It's good radio.
To establish a standpoint, right? To establish a standpoint, I would have been fine not rereading Hitchhiker's Guide, right? And I read this. I'm not sure how many times I read this when I was a teenager. Three or four probably sounds about right. But I read it enough that while I could not have told you every plot point ahead of time, like, none of the surprising things were surprising, right? Yeah. And so I found, like, coming back to it with a decent amount of familiarity as an adult, I just wasn't, I was neither moved nor entertained, honestly, to reread it. And I think in some ways, actually, that the ubiquity that you point to is a disservice to the experience of reading the novel, right? If I had never been reminded of, if the movie had never existed and I had never been reminded of the question of life, the universe and everything, and the answer being 42, and none of that stuff, you know, if there weren't a Radiohead song called Paranoid Android, if none of that stuff, if it didn't have such a cultural afterlife, it might have been more possible to experience some amount of entertainment and surprise and joy rereading the thing after 30-odd years, 20-odd years, you know. But, yeah, it's just that that cultural half-life, in fact, has kind of made it, it's taken away any ability, for me at least, to actually enjoy engaging with the text. And, you know, maybe if it were, maybe if I were to go further in the series and, you know, get a, my sense is that, you know, Mostly Harmless, for instance, there's a lot less stuff in that that's everywhere in the same way, right? Maybe I would have a different experience to go further. As far as why it's had that cultural ubiquity, two thoughts, I think. One is, I think that, you know, it's incredibly, incredibly difficult to do this, but if you're an artist who can make something that appears complex or appears sophisticated, but is in fact approachable by somebody who has a completely normal level of aesthetic sophistication, then you, people are really going to love you, right? Like, I'm thinking of the band Tool, right? Like, Tool... And Tool, in many ways, are doing incredibly smart things, right? But, like, much of what seems to be smart about Tool can actually be understood and appreciated by somebody who just isn't that good at interpreting complex music, right? I'm trying to, like, not sound like a snob as much as possible with this stuff. And this is a novel that, you know, a 14-year-old of average intelligence can read it and pretty much get all the concepts and the jokes and the philosophical stuff. And it having that experience, I think, flatters people's sense of themselves, right? So it's like that kind of work. I think people appreciate it because it flatters their sense of themselves by making them feel smart. And it's what seems to be a relatively sophisticated work, which is not in any way unapproachable or difficult. And that's incredibly hard to do, to be clear, right? Like, if I could do that as an artist, I'd be doing it. And in many ways, like, I've spent my whole career in, you know, every medium I've worked in trying to do that while in fact failing, right? So I don't mean at all to play down that achievement, even though I may be framing it in ways which sound condescending. But I think mega that family. Is... Yeah, yeah. But that's, I think, the root of its success. One of the roots of its success. I think the other thing about enduring is that, like, once something achieves a certain level of presence, once it goes above a certain threshold, that becomes self-reinforcing because, you know, like I reread Hamlet the other day, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Hamlet is good or not, right? I can't say that I had, you know, unmitigated entertainment and pleasure just reading Hamlet. But so much of it is so familiar that, like, part of the experience of reading Hamlet is just, even, you know, I've read Hamlet a few times, but there's still that sense of, like, oh, shit, that's where that turn of phrase came from. Oh, conscience makes mm-hmm. cowards of us all. That's in here? Oh, like, you know, there are things in the language, there are things in everyday spoken English that we don't even think of as having an origin, right? Because they've been with us for so long. They're so ubiquitous. And you read Hamlet and you're like, oh, somebody just came up with that phrase, right? Like, yeah. It's weird. And, you know, I think, you know, once something achieves, or like Space Odyssey, right? Like a friend of mine, you met my friend Autumn at my wedding, I think. She watched the movie Space Odyssey and she said, I hated it. I hated watching it as a movie, but it was so valuable to understanding other texts, right? And I think once something achieves a certain level of ubiquity, it's very hard to make it go away because the fact of its influence becomes something which reinforces its continued presence, and then its continued presence reinforces the ways in which it lends that influence. And this text has kind of broken through that threshold, I think, because of that quality of making people feel sophisticated for reading it who normally would balk at a sophisticated text.
I'm sorry now that we weren't recording earlier, because actually I feel like this could bridge onto something that we were talking about before we started recording, which is that sort of like when something that is a subjective, like a subjective value becomes an intersubjective value. And what you're talking about, Hans, is like this text, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, somehow like kind of hit, it resonated with a broad subset of people in, you know, a bunch of different fields with a bunch of, basically, like, Patrick, you didn't use these words, but I think you kind of were hinting that it's kind of a grab bag. It's got a lot of like ideas that aren't really fleshed out, you know, too much beyond just kind of like gesturing sort of in some kind of pithy way in their direction. Mm. And it does, I think you're right, Hans. It feels, I don't think that like you, the way that you're framing it, I know you're not intending for it to be patronizing. I think that it is like, it's very gracious novel for being such a kind of sarcastic one.
I'm and there certainly is this aware kind of that I'm shared... being patronizing, by the way. I'm trying to avoid it, but it's not working.
So I know. Yeah, I think. Well, another way to frame it is like it's not like, I'm reminded of there's a family friend, you know, I have Guitar Pete, and he's basically a session musician who's played with, you know, like Woody Nelson and Kris Kristofferson, and basically like that whole sort of bent of folks on various tours. And he was in his 50s, and he actually was talking with us about how he finally learned to kind of play within himself, like in that unlocking a kind of a new sort of like actually like a new level for him to kind of play at, which is sort of paradoxical. But I feel like this novel plays within a very broad, like sort of like Venn overlapping of a lot of Venn diagrams of like basically being inclusive and gracious to, you know, people of you know, who you know, don't necessarily read philosophy, don't necessarily read sci-fi, people who do read philosophy, people who do read sci-fi, and somehow kind of is in, like, readable and enjoyable to all of those folks. And I guess, like, I'm kind of moving back to that intersubjectivity conversation that, unfortunately, we weren't recording. Is that a skill? Is that an aesthetic skill to basically target like a broad audience and be, to kind of like, if you were to sort of be Machiavellian about it and just sort of, and I don't think that Adams was this way, but like to basically say, I want this, what I'm creating, this piece of art, to break that threshold and to become a currency that future pieces of art and future endeavors use or mine from in order to kind of like speak to that same crowd, you know, like basically like become part of sort of the cultural lexicon. Is that something that you can try to do, or is it an accident?
Well, I think that you can try to make things accessible. And I don't think, it seems obvious to me that this was made with the goal of accessibility. I think the level of ubiquity and influence that's achieved must have been accidental. Well, sorry, Patrick, go ahead.
No, I was essentially going to express the same idea. I think you can try to be accessible, but like being culturally ubiquitous is always going to be an accident. Absolutely.
I actually think my next question builds on that because I'm in it. I'm bringing up the movie that most recently won Best Picture, which I think is weirdly similar because Everything Everywhere All at Once is certainly like really, really, really enjoyable. I dug it. I really had a fun time. And at the same time, it makes very sincere, very well-crafted, broad gestures toward nihilistic, existentialist, philosophical concepts, as well as really, you know, sort of almost saccharine, but not quite there, very sweet immigrant family, new American, like, struggles. And it just basically sort of is striking our culture right now in a way that, like, I can't really imagine that movie winning Best Picture in any other year. Like, and maybe that's just not appreciative of the fact that, like, that movie would strike a chord with people no matter when it came out. But one of the, like, a very explicit concept in that movie, and I think a pretty explicit concept in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, is very kind of explicit nihilism and the meaninglessness of everything. Like, in the series, the guidebook series, there's really nothing that earns a character a quicker sort of pratfall than trying to find meaning in the universe. There is no meaning to be found. It is, at best, just hilarious how indifferent the universe is to any individual being in the universe. And Everything Everywhere All at Once, it's pretty striking to me that such a movie would be so popular when that seems to also be a pretty consistent theme, a pretty explicit theme in that. So we have these two really popular works of art that were kind of made popular, that achieved that popularity, that crossed that threshold in a, you know, a country that is still, you know, sort of, I would say, broadly unconvinced of the meaninglessness of the universe, and, you know, largely, you know, still religious. And so it's just interesting to me that these two works would achieve popularity. I'm curious if, I mean, is this too simple a question to ask? Like, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy achieved popularity in the late 70s, early 80s, a time of a lot of geopolitical, like, paranoia and a lot of just sort of like general fear about the future of the world. I think we're in a similar space now. Is there a relationship between troubled times and books about nihilism?
Well, I mean, I think that, like, Everything Everywhere All at Once, it makes gestures at nihilism. But the point of that movie is actually, the point is just to love and be kind to one another, right? Like, that, and maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but I don't think it's actually really, if it's pretending to be more complicated than that, it's faking, right? Like it uses some ideas from philosophy or science to kind of build up this sort of a free associative universe, but then the way of resolving the conflict is to say, actually, now all the characters have figured out that loving and being kind to one another matters, and nothing, maybe nothing else matters, but that matters, and now they're all saved by that revelation, right? Which is, I mean, it's fine enough as a device, but I think it's very, very, very different from Hitchhiker's Guide in that way.
Hitchhiker's Guide is not warm. It's really actually, right, like you mentioned, mostly harmless. Mostly Harmless is deeply depressing. In fact, a lot of people don't like Mostly Harmless because it is so depressing. But go on.
And that's, I mean, to some extent, like even though I haven't been that kind to re-encountering hitchhikers, I do appreciate the fact that, you know, like when I watched the movie, if I remember right, I think the movie kind of orchestrates like a happy love ending between Trillian and Arthur Dent. And it's like, fuck that. You know, that's, if there's anything that I still appreciate, it's the spirit of the series that does in fact resist that sort of tidy resolution of that sort of thing. And I mean, Everything Everywhere, it really actually seems to me to be very, in two significant ways, very different from Hitchhiker's Guide. To be clear, I really enjoyed watching Everything Everywhere. I think I might be about to be condescending to that movie too, but like, I think to the extent that movie appears to involve, like Hitchhiker's Guide, you know, the gestures toward philosophy and science are actually coming from a level of, there is sophistication there and there are interesting concepts. Everything Everywhere, it's sort of like it hand waves at a certain amount of, you know, quantum theory and parallel universe theory and philosophy, but only to the very minimal level required to throw a bunch of wacky shit at the audience, you know. I don't think it's nearly as sophisticated as this work in that regard. But also from an emotional standpoint, I think like you made the point that maybe the geopolitical situation feels similar between now and the late 70s. I can't speak to that, but I don't think that, I mean, if you take it as a given that that is the case, Everything Everywhere responds to that by giving everybody a big hug. And this text responds to that by saying, yeah, actually, you know, it's fair to be depressed and feel pointless and meaningless. So they actually, if they are responding to a similar climate, they're doing so in what seem to actually to be diametrically opposed ways to me.
I have a question that is kind of moves in a different direction. I haven't seen Everything Everywhere All at Once because I don't like movies anymore. Like, I don't really like watching movies or TV shows or anything. Like, I just put a food channel on some food video on YouTube until I fall asleep is really all I ever do. But you said something, Hans, like you mentioned how the film version orchestrates a happy ending between Arthur and Trillian. And I remember seeing the film and finding that, even though I hadn't read the book, I found it a little, I didn't like it. Like, I think I didn't think it was that successful.
It feels unearned, as I recall.
Right. Unearned. And that just brings me to a little bit of a criticism I have of this novel, which is that it simply ends.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that is, you know, obviously in an age where it is so unheard of for a science fiction or fantasy book to be standalone, and that's been going on for years and years and years, you know, like, certainly in the 80s when this would have been first published. So, you know, the idea that this would have continued on into a second novel or a third novel probably would have been very familiar to people in 1980 or whatever, you know. But still, it seems like a critical misstep. Like, come on, you still have to have a whole story with an actual ending, right? Don't you? Or is it, or you guys didn't that didn't bother?
No, it's a very fair criticism. And really Hans, you actually mentioned it when we were talking about reading this novel. Like, you had read all of them, maybe out of order, and there wasn't really a clear, cohesive ending for you. And I think even though there is a very, very resounding ending, which I can tell you guys, or remind you if
yeah, Douglas Adams died. And couldn't write anymore.
Well, at the end of Mostly Harmless,
is that the last one?
That's the last one. Do you want me to tell you, Patrick?
Yeah, go ahead. I might actually read more of these, but I don't really care knowing the ending. That's fine. Go ahead.
I think that it doesn't really matter because there isn't really there is a lot of actually, it does put down, it's not that it comes out of nowhere, and it will make sense, I think, even given what I've described so far. But basically, the guide Mark II, so the second edition of the guide for which Ford Prefect is sort of doing the sort of legwork to kind of put together additional information together for the guide. The guide Mark II is an artificial intelligence that is actually sort of terrifyingly powerful because of its broad knowledge of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Even worse, it's purchased by the Vogon bureaucracy. And the Vogon bureaucracy adjusts its algorithm to communicate to, I don't remember the names of the aliens, but some other group of aliens who are very, very into horoscopes, that the existence of the planet Earth in space basically communicates an undesirable horoscope. Basically, it's like it signifies an undesirable horoscope to all of their race, so to all of them. So basically, in every dimension, because this is like an interdimensional species, they seek out the Earth and destroy it with every single version of Arthur Dent and Trillian and everybody basically visiting Earth at that time. So everyone, every Earth, every character dies. So it's very much an end. It's like, it's an ending. It's an ending. But it's not like there's a kind of like a dramatic arc that takes you there. It's mostly that this was always going to be the ending. Like the only thing that you get at the end is that Arthur is not afraid anymore of dying, and kind of at peace with the meaninglessness of it all.
Right.
And the reason the Vogon bureaucracy seeks to destroy all of these versions of Earth, by the way, is that it's just in their paperwork that they're supposed to do that. Like, so it's it's kind of a sort of like a, from the movie Brazil or something like that. It's just a
buttle tuttle thing. Right?
The banality of evil. Yeah. So like they, you know, and that's it. Like that's the ending of the book. And it's, a lot of people hate that book. Cause it is really kind of a downer, but it's very consistent. Hans, you're absolutely right. Like, I think I'll push back to say that like Everything Everywhere All at Once, it's the central sort of emotional sort of tension is based on the fact that these characters have to accept and internalize the massive indifference of a random universe. But they turn in a completely different direction from the characters in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, in kind of creating a bubble of meaning within that space. And that option is not explored or just not entertained at all, or not possible in the Douglas Adams universe. Like these characters don't have that these books don't have that warmth.
Just to sum up, so I'm correct that it's that this novel doesn't have a it doesn't have a narrative arc that closes up, and it doesn't really seem like the whole series does either, is what you're saying.
No, it's a series of scenes. I mean, it's very this is Monty Python-esque. Like, this is a it is a series of funny encounters that are clever. Monty Python actually occupies a similar space in the cultural sort of like Monty Python is seen decades, you know, from when it was, you know, created as this very erudite, clever, you know, it's basically like mythologized as a piece of like pop art and humor. Even though basic and like the people behind it, John Cleese, Gilliam, all of them are sort of elevated, you know, right? They're up there with like them, like the most highly regarded sort of like,
Gilliam smart, humorous, done great films as a director, really.
Oh, and awful ones, truly awful ones. Like he's done both, like he's done really bad movies, but some great ones too. But the Monty Python was silly. Like it wasn't trying to. It's interesting the space that it occupies, and I think that it is similar to that of the Guide series. But your criticism is absolutely right, Patrick. Like it does not have an arc that takes it to an ending. The first book doesn't even really have an ending. It just stops. And I'd say that most of the books kind of do that. Mm. That's because I don't think that sort of shape, that sort of like dramatic arc shape, it implies a kind of a, I don't think that it's needed for what this book does, which is to basically kind of lampoon a bunch of shit.
Right. And yeah, like certainly there are so many memorable scenes and ideas that, you know, not being narratively cohesive is like, if it's not super worried about it. So, and that's okay. Like a whale falling to its death is pretty fantastic.
Oh man, it's great. I don't care how patronizing Hans is. I freaking love this book. But I am interested in humor as a craft. I mean, like, I don't think I generally seek out funny books. Do you, either of you guys, seek out funny books? I sound like an old man.
I do. All the time.
Do you guys seek out funny books?
Yeah. I do anyway.
Like, you do,
I don't think that I do. I mean, I think most of the books that I love have some aspect of humor, but I think in general, most texts that are primarily oriented toward being humorous, I don't really like. There's exceptions to that, but
That seems most strange to me that you would say that.
Well, what do you think of me as liking that is primarily aimed at being humorous? Other than Mystery Science Theater. I'll cop to that one.
I don't know. It seems like all of your favorite books, or at least writers, have such a ironic distance from their subject matter that like the not the most you can get out of them, but like I would say, like, when you're ironically distant from the subject of a novel as a writer or a reader, one of the primary emotions that you're going to respond with is humor, right?
So, and you're thinking here of like a DeLillo or a Ballard or a Pynchon.
DeLillo, Ballard, Pynchon, or, you know, David Foster Wallace. Yeah. Like, it seems like...
I mean,
like
those are all authors with some amount of humor, but there's a great deal of other things going on in all those books. I guess, I mean, books are kind of interesting now that I think about it, because like there's a whole genre of movies that are that are comedies, right? That only exist to be funny. Or they don't right. only exist to be funny, but to the extent that they have other things, to the extent that they have narrative arcs and character arcs and plots, those are obviously understood to just be in the service of humor, right?
Sure.
I'm actually not sure, and maybe I'm just completely overlooking something. Within the realm of novels, I guess there aren't that many things that are, like, what is a novel that is just a comedy?
Something like a book by John Scalzi, like the sci-fi writer. He does these sci-fi humor novels. Like,
I really can't stand those novels.
Oh, you can't?
But I can't stand them, but they are funny. Like, they're just so pithy that I can't.
Right.
They're so clever. But no, but you're saying that that's those are.
I'm just saying that their intention is primarily to amuse you, right?
Yeah.
Amuse the reader.
I guess, like, I don't. I just am not. I'm trying to think of whether or not there's. If I've never heard of John Scalzi, so I can't speak to that. But I mean, I don't think of there being that many books that have no intention other than to be amusing, in the way that something like, I don't know, a scary movie film really has.
Yeah,
nothing
I mean,
except comedy.
I suppose I was just being. I was like mistakenly being reductive. Like, yeah, like. David Foster Wallace or DeLillo or Pynchon, like one effect of their work is humor, but they're also, you know, deeply, they're all very idea-based writers with deep, interesting themes that they're trying to get at, right?
But I also, I mean, I think when I first responded to the question, I made it sound as though I were rejecting something that I'm now saying I'm not sure actually exists, right? So I mean, if you were pushing back on what I was saying, it was probably fair to do so, because I was presenting myself as rejecting a version of writing that I can't actually think of any examples of. But
sure.
I guess the question was, do I seek out books for the sake of humor? I think that I seek out books for other reasons, but often the ones I like the most happen to, among other things, be humorous.
Is humor then really, like, humor unto itself is not, humor unto itself is an effective, like, thing in media, but I guess, like, humor is a tool in those cases. Like, David Foster Wallace is not just cracking jokes.
Right.
Like, David Foster Wallace is first and foremost exploring, like, a porn convention. Is it a porn star convention?
Yeah, that's one of his essays in Consider the Lobster.
Yeah, Consider the Lobster. And the
Which
humor
is funny.
It's really funny. It's great. Yeah. That's immediately the one I thought of. You know, but it's not his goal to just make people laugh. Like, he's having fun exploring this very unique experience and writing about it. And then, like, humor becomes a tool in that.
Or, I mean, we read a David Foster Wallace. It's been a long time, but we read, I think, a novella of his on this podcast, The Suffering Channel, right? And that's...
Right.
That has some comic, absurd, humorous elements to it. Where the guy poops little sculptures.
Yeah.
And that has some aspects of humor to it, but there are also many very poignant things about that story. And, I mean, the relationship of those tones, I think, you can make critiques of, but they're all there, right? The tones and the points are... all there.
I also think we should bring up, like, the Sotweed factor, which is probably my favorite.
Oh, it's no, you're right. That, like, it was hilarious.
My favorite
novel
that is both hilarious and, like, very deeply poignant is definitely the Sotweed factor.
That's an
that's like probably my top 10 books. Like, just it's so good. I loved it, man. I loved it. I want to read more, but they took off all of the John Barth's stuff from Audible. So I don't know why, but.
Yeah, I think that. Yeah, it's no longer acceptable to describe penises as eggplants.
Oh, do you think he got canceled?
No, I'm joking. I don't think that he was canceled, but there is quite a bit. If there was sort of a broad cancel movement that reached that far back in like American literature, I would not be surprised if the Sotweed factor came up. For sure.
Yeah,
for sure. There's a lot of rape in the Sotweed factor.
Yeah.
He published another really big novel around that time, or very like just physically imposing novel around that time called Giles Goat Boy that is also fairly cancelable for a few different reasons. But anyway.
Well, okay, we've drifted pretty far.
You were talking about Human Hitchhiker's Guide, right? And I just I want to say, am I the only one who felt like some of the jokes got repeated a few times too often? Am I in a minority in that regard?
Give me some examples, and then I'll know whether I
am. Like, the doors enjoy opening themselves. The computer wants to be friendly. Like that, I felt like the doors kept enjoying opening themselves a few times after it was funny. The computer's friendliness kind of kept being assertive kind of after it stopped being funny. The digital watches, I think about the third time there was a reference to a digital watch, I was like, yes, digital watches are pointless. I get it. Maybe some of that comes from familiarity, right? If I were encountering it cold for the first time, the humor was a bit less repetitive.
I'm sure the third time they mentioned the digital watch, I was no longer interested. Like, the first time's funny, the second time is a callback and works, and then the third time doesn't.
So I agree, but I also think your question illuminates for me. This novel for me is like the Rockettes, right? Like, this novel for me is like, people pay exorbitant goddamn amounts of money to go watch a show that has been put on for decades that is, you know, like, pretty empty of anything like basically like you go see the Rockettes, and I'm not interested in the Rockettes, but like still people go to this show and pay a lot of money to see it on Broadway around Christmas because it's like, it's kind of what you expect. It is kind of like, and I'll say, I don't care how many times those callbacks, even though I know, like, objectively, if I can appreciate the aesthetic objective fail of that, but I still fucking love it. It still makes me laugh. And I'm just, like, does that make sense to you guys? Like, maybe it's just, like, when I read this novel, some way that it hit me. Is that something that is... Does everybody have that with like some works of art? Is that just a naive appreciation of a piece of art? Like, it just makes me crack up. It does not stop making me crack up, no matter how many times it comes up, even though I know you're both right.
Well, so there is there's my favorite joke, and every time I tell it to somebody else, I crack up. Like, I've heard it a million times because I've told it a million times. I think it's hilarious, even if it is, like, totally stupid. Its stupidity is part of the reason why I laugh every time. So certainly it's possible for something to not... Like, the humor could be aesthetically wrong or aesthetically off in some way, and you still find it funny.
I think that kind of comfort food process that you're talking about, Chris, is totally legitimate, and I have my own versions of that. Yeah, I think that's totally understandable. Right. And as a rejoinder, absolutely. I think it's a fair one. It's just not a relationship that I have with the text, you know. So,
right.
No, but it's total. I think that just to kind of button up this discussion, because I do think it's hard to kind of have a discussion about like the craft of the piece of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, because it's really hard to sort of hang that amount of attention on, you know, what's going on in here, unless you're going to basically like analyze individual jokes. And, but I am, I think, like still sort of fascinated by what this book and what similar works of art that occupy similar spaces in like the zeitgeist mean to like our culture, like how they just sort of like persist. And I think that this is just one of those books, those comfort food, like works of, you know, art or creative expression that just hit enough people in the right way to kind of defy its own gravity. And I don't know if that, I don't think we necessarily like came down on like a formula for how that's done craft wise. It seems like it's just sort of chance and skill, but it's the book hits me. It's captured me in that particular net. Like I can never evaluate it objectively because I am so in its thrall, and I will always laugh at it. And I hope everybody has such a comfort food, something to kind of turn to when the world is dark and terrible and full of monsters. But
it's funny that you find it comforting when you've also said that it's not warm. It's not like it really is like, hey, there's no meaning.
And it is weird. Yeah. No, it is. I don't know why. Patrick, like, I don't generally find things like this comforting. I think of more of that your sort of aesthetic inclination to turn toward works of art that sort of capture or try to sort of capture or insist on the indifference of the universe, and you being sort of at least aesthetically attracted to those. I can find those very off-putting. For whatever reason, I read this and it gives me actually kind of, even if it isn't buttoned up as sentimentally as Everything Everywhere All at Once, I still find it comforting somehow. And I don't know why.
Maybe because finding humor in the meaninglessness is a type of meaning, whereas I just really think it's meaningless. And it's not funny.
So you're just reading this with a straight face?
No, I think this is hilarious. This is a hilarious, funny book. But like if you really are really putting your mind into how meaningless things are, which I do sometimes, you know, sometimes I read legitimately pessimistic philosophy that is trying to logically prove that life is horrible and things like that, you know, that's not funny. You know, it's not really funny. It's super depressing and you have to stop reading it. But this is hilarious.
Maybe that's what it is. It's the sublime experience of confronting the darkness of that, but having a good time doing
right,
it.
Right. Exactly.
Any of you want to call out any parts of the novel that we didn't touch upon? We didn't really talk about the novel so much as talk about its place. But I think that it may be...
Yeah, my favorite part, I think, is where Zaphod uses one of his heads to perform oral on himself.
Yeah.
That was also my favorite part of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, what's his name?
Sam Rockwell.
Sam Rockwell really sold that.
Really sold the
autofellatio. One face was making all the... Yeah, the autofellatio.
Of one of his heads. I don't know. Like, Sam Rockwell is obviously great, but I'm not sure I like the whole, like, his other head is, like, hidden below his head. I didn't see that in the book. It seemed like he just had two heads.
He just has two heads in the book. And then if you look at the stage plays, one of the heads is just sort of a mounted on the shoulder of
of the actor.
Of the stage actor, yeah. Yeah, I think that was maybe a decision. Like, they probably figured out early on in the production process that animating a non-Uncanny Valley Sam Rockwell face next to his other face, or trying to even, like, I guess, like, record him twice and put the faces, they probably figured out that it was too much of a pain in the ass, and then they were like, let's just come up with some. That's what I feel like a lot of adaptations, rather than aesthetic decisions, that sort of make make them change
production,
the, you know,
decisions, basically.
Yeah, it's more production decisions, and that's one of them, because this is a, I think, the if you haven't seen the old BBC like miniseries, that's great.
Is it?
Like, that's fucking hilarious, because it has a lot of patience with what it is. It's like, I don't know, like 8 or 9 episodes.
Sure.
And it is like, and the graphics are shitty and everything like that, but it's way better than the movie, because they do change some stuff, because I think Douglas Adams was involved, and it's a different medium, and you should change stuff. But, like, they changed it to make it fucking funnier, and it is really funny. So, but they kind of turned Trillian into a bit of a dim bulb, if I remember right, which
in
is
the movie?
Unfortunate. In, I think, the series.
Oh, the
I
series.
Think that was, yeah, that was unfortunate. But anyway, we're far afield.
We're talking about the various mediums that it's been in, and it didn't even start as a novel. So I don't know if it's far, far afield.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's almost 50 years old, like you.
I'm not almost 50 years old. You guys are almost 40.
We are almost 40.
I am definitely
Patrick.
Almost
that's
40.
How that
I can't argue with
that. Fucking, that's how that works, man. Like, we're going on 40.
Yeah.
You're not going on 45. You're going on 50. Patrick.
No, I'm going on 45.
No, you're not. You're 40. You're young. You're young yet, Patrick.
Oh, that was a good. Was a good tie-in. A good callback.
I'll just have to remind everyone of it one more time before the podcast is over to really frustrate Hans. Thank you very much for talking about this childhood love of mine, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And it sounds like, Patrick, were you enjoyed it, but you didn't really find it very deep or moving or anything like that.
Oh, no. I thought it was great. I definitely thought, I mean, the characters, like, there weren't any really, like, deep character stuff. But, you know, like... I mentioned it a couple of times. I actually thought, like, the whale thing was both hilarious and deeply moving. Like, you know, like the impermanence of existence. Like, you're all excited and then it just ends, right? Like, yeah. I mean, I do think there is a lot to love about this, and I thoroughly enjoyed listening to it. And I definitely felt like there was some deep shit in it. Absolutely. Like, you know, as I said, there's not a lot of deep character stuff, which, you know, is maybe objectively, quote unquote, makes a better novel. But as an experience, this was great. Stephen Fry was the narrator of the audiobook I listened to. And,
oh, cool.
And he's
awesome. That's
awesome. So, yeah, it was great.
I do recommend at least reading the next book, Patrick, because that really actually does sort of kind of complete an arc. Some of the stuff that's like hinted at in the first novel.
I think I will actually.
Gets more or less completed there. And it is, I think it's, I'm remembering it now. I think actually a lot of the things that I really think back on, fondly about are in that one.
Mm.
But I still appreciate reading this with you guys. So thank you very much.
My pleasure. Not Hans's, though.
No, I know. But I actually, that makes it even better for me. All right, what are we reading next?
So I don't know anything about this novel. I read a review of it that seemed intriguing, and I've now forgotten everything from the review. I'm not, I feel like we've kind of abandoned the theme that we had for a while of trying to connect our next pick.
Is it Spare by Prince Harry?
It is. We're going to read Spare by. That's it.
Oh, God.
Go ahead, man.
No, our next pick is Checkout 19 by Claire Louise Bennett.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us, everybody. Next episode, we'll be talking about Checkout 19 by Claire Louise Bennett. And hope everyone has a fine day. Bye, y'all.
Peace out, dudes.